If you've ever toyed with the idea of having a home birth, but you wondered A, where on earth to begin, and B, what it's really like to birth your baby at home supported by a privately practicing midwife, then this is the episode for you. Because today's episode is kind of a home birth 101. Welcome to the Wild Mother Podcast for women who want to birth, mother, and live with pleasure, purpose, and power. The wisdom of Mother Nature is our guide as we dive deep into the subjects of physiologic birth, natural parenting, and conscious mothering. Join me, Dr. Jessica Hodgins, for evidence-based and soul-centered conversation with guest experts and real mamas just like you. Let's go. Whenever I talk to mamas considering a home birth, it's always the basics. It's the what, why, and how that they most want to know. And this was me too as a newly pregnant mama. And the thing is, unless you know someone who's had a home birth, it's really hard to find this basic information. And that's why I created this episode, as a resource for anyone considering choosing home birth with a private midwife. I recently had the privilege of speaking with the wonderful Dr. Melanie Jackson, who you might know better from her Instagram and YouTube channels as Melanie the Midwife. Today, Mel and I go into all the details about everything you need to know about how to have a home birth, how to go about finding a home birth midwife, what it's like to have your own private midwife during your pregnancy, what happens during the birth, and yes, we also cover what happens if you need a transfer into hospital, and what it's like to have your own private midwife on call for you after your baby is born to support you during the early postpartum. So if you haven't come across Melanie Jackson yet, let me tell you a little bit about her. Mel has been a privately practicing midwife and providing home birth services for 13 years since 2009. Alongside her work as a midwife, she completed her PhD, called Birth Outside the System, in 2015, and she's held positions in midwifery research, midwifery lecturing, and national policy development at the Australian College of Midwives. Mel has a brilliant YouTube channel where she breaks down research papers relevant to pregnancy and birth, so you'll definitely want to check that out. It's linked in the show notes. And she also runs some incredible online programs. So Transformative Birthwork is her online program to support pregnant women and families navigate the maternity system. And if you're a midwife and you've ever considered moving into private practice, Mel also offers an online mentorship for midwives wanting to launch into private practice. So both of those are linked in the show notes. And safe to say, Mel is an absolute gift for women, families, and birth workers. And it's my privilege to have her on the show. Now, Mel and I ended up chatting for a lot longer than planned in this conversation because we just basically had so much to say. So today's episode is the first half of our conversation. And next week, I'll be sharing the second half of our convo where we talk about Mel's research into birth outside the system and what we as women, as consumers, can do to support home birth midwifery. Because you might not know this, but this model of care is actually under threat. So be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss that episode. It's pretty epic. Oh, and that's right. I did say next week because the Wild Mother Podcast is about to go weekly. Things are gearing up here, guys. Okay, so here is Dr. Melanie Jackson with everything you ever wanted to know about what it's like to have a privately practicing midwife support you through your journey into motherhood. So Mel, welcome to the Wild Mother Podcast. I'm so excited to have you here and I'm trying not to fangirl too hard because I'm such a massive fan of everything you do. And I'm excited to talk to you today about birth outside the system and a little bit about home birth midwifery as well. And you're a privately practicing midwife and a midwifery researcher who literally wrote your thesis on exactly this subject. So I couldn't imagine a more qualified person to have this conversation with. So can you start by telling us what you do? Because I know you wear many hats. And also, I'd love to hear about the journey that's led you to this work. Like what led you to become a midwife researcher?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I can start from the beginning of my story, I suppose. I was a naturopath as my first training. And then I just thought it would be really lovely to specialize in caring for women and babies. So I thought, what can I do to qualify myself for that? And I was just kind of led down the path towards midwifery. It was then that I discovered that at that time you had to be a nurse in order to be a midwife. Yes. And there was the new Bachelor of Midwifery course, which when I inquired about that, they said they wouldn't give me any prior recognition for my learning as a naturopath. So I decided that I was committed. I did want to be a midwife as well as a naturopath. And so I decided to do a master's of nursing and then go straight into midwifery, which was the same amount of time as doing a bachelor of midwifery. So that's how I got to kind of into midwifery. And that was probably where my academic career began, because I hadn't really thought about further study until I had to consider it in order to get to midwifery. At the same time, a friend of mine was planning a home birth, which was the first I'd ever heard of home birth. And she knew I was getting into midwifery, and she thought that maybe I would get value out of coming to her birth. So I just thought, wow, now I've got to prepare myself. What is home birth? I have no idea. I have only just really discovered midwifery. And so the first book I read was Ina May Gaskin's Spiritual Midwifery. And I could feel my mind expanding as I read it, because I didn't really know really anything about birth, and my mum hadn't given me any fear about birth. She just said, oh yeah, I went into labor and then I went to the hospital and I pushed you out and then I came home, and she never spoke about pain, or so I didn't have any real idea about or fears about birth anyway. So when I read that book, there was instant clarification for me about what birth was and how our bodies act in, you know, while we give birth. And so right from there, I was like, that's it. I'm going to be a home birth midwife, because this makes so much sense. Through my studies as a naturopath, I just loved anatomy and physiology, and I loved understanding how the body worked. And I felt like when the way that it was explained in that book in Spiritual Midwifery, you could understand how the anatomy and physiology of birth actually is allowed to unfold at home. And so that made a lot of sense. You know, when we talk about oxytocin requiring privacy and safety and all these things, I thought, well, yeah, it makes total sense that this would happen at home. So then I spent my nursing time, my master's, just reading midwifery books. And anytime that I got a chance to pick the topic of my assessments, it would be all about birth and midwifery. And I actually did get through the master's with first class honors anyway, despite the fact that I was not at all invested in learning about nursing. So that's how I got to midwifery. And then, yeah, from there, it was just a complete focus on being a home birth midwife, which is what I did. After finishing midwifery, I just went straight into home birth. I didn't do a new grad year. I didn't do any work in the hospital. I don't really know about medically managed birth. My definite specialty is home birth.
Oh, that is so refreshing to hear and so rare, I would imagine, because it kind of reminds me of my own, how I came to birth as well, with kind of like you, not a whole lot of knowledge. And then I heard Dr. Sarah Buckley talk about physiologic birth at home. I was like, oh yeah, totally. It makes so much sense. And then read Ina May Gaskin and had my baby at home, because I was just like, well, why would I birth anywhere else? But I feel like it's so rare to come to it with almost a clean slate about birth. And then of course, home birth makes sense.
Yes. And that's what happens too, is that for some women and for some midwives, there's a lot of undoing before you get to even the basics of feeling like you can trust birth. So I have been very fortunate that I haven't had an opportunity to start fearing birth, because as I watch it at home more and more, people sort of ask, you know, oh my gosh, what if something goes wrong? And I'm like, well, actually, in 13 years of just sitting and watching birth, it mostly goes right, actually. And if it didn't, I don't think I could hang around and keep doing this job if it went wrong so often.
And it's but your description of that, I think, is really telling of sitting around and watching birth, of not actively managing it, but watching it. It's a very different way of approaching birth.
Yes. And I mean, I talk to my clients too about, you know, they're like, oh, what do you do when you come to the birth? And I just say to them, look, I arrive, I set up my gear, most of which we never use. And then the only time you really need a midwife is if something is going wrong or you feel like you want some help. Otherwise, it's me just sitting back and watching to see that the process is unfolding in a physiological way and just kind of flagging if I think it might be going off track. Mm-hmm. So, yes, as a home birth midwife, there's just a lot of sensible watching and, you know, there's a lot going on in our minds but not in our bodies.
So one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was, what is it like to hire a home birth midwife from the perspective of a woman? So if a woman found out she was pregnant and she's already got to a point where she's decided that she wants to have a home birth or is interested in having a home birth, what is the first step? Because this is what I find so many women, and I know I was like this too. I was like, where do I even start? Because it's such a new world. Like, the whole world of birth is so new. Where would a woman start if she wants to find out about hiring a home birth midwife?
Yeah. At this point in history, private midwives are really sought after. Mm-hmm. So what you want is to really contact them almost the minute you find out you're pregnant. But even better than that is, I have a lot of clients who are not yet pregnant. They know they're planning on conceiving and they start their journey of trying to identify which midwife they would want. Mm-hmm. So the first step is basically, if you are planning on having a baby and you think you might want a home birth, I would recommend that women just start searching for which home birth midwife they might want. Mm-hmm. You can start, you can ask around. So there's a lot of Facebook groups of women who have had home births, and also just Googling like home birth midwives in your area. Mm-hmm. So basically you want to identify and maybe find the one that you think is right for you, and you can call them and actually tell them about your plans. I'm thinking about getting pregnant. I'm looking for a private midwife, and seeking information about which one would be best, because, you know, midwives all have different personalities and different ways of working. So it's important to find the one that you feel like is right for you. Mm. So you can start even before you're pregnant, because then when you are pregnant, you really want to phone them early and say, I'm pregnant, can I book in? Because sometimes, you know, when you're 8 to 10 weeks, the midwives can already be booked out, with women that have been considering home birth for a long time and have already picked their private midwife. Mm. So that would be step one, is right from the beginning.
Yeah.
Start to search.
Yeah. And I feel like it's really important to say that, because a lot of us, and like I was like this, I kind of did already do my research, but I didn't call any midwives because I was like, I didn't want to seem too over the top. And I was also, I think I almost didn't want to jinx conceiving. Like, I didn't want to, whereas now, in hindsight, I was really fortunate to have a choice of midwives, but that's also where I am locally. We've got a range of beautiful independent midwives. That's not the case everywhere. Yeah, I just got really lucky. But yeah, just to like to know that it's okay to reach out during, like, even before you conceive, and it's actually a really wise step.
Yes. Well, yeah, because you might just miss out. Mm. You know, women think they ring at 8 weeks and go, I'm pregnant, and I'm about to hire you. And I'm like, I'm booked out.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the hard thing, is that there are so few midwives. Mm-hmm. There's about 200 private midwives in all of Australia. You know, it's not enough.
Yeah.
So that would be step one, is to really understand which midwife you want, so that the minute you're pregnant, you can just ring them. Yes, that would be step one. And then there's actually very active home birth communities. So the best information you can get is from other women who have had home births. Mm-hmm. So they'll give you recommendations for local midwives that, you know, midwives start to get reputations. And so women are very intuitive to that. And they'll say, yeah, that's the one, and that's the one. And, you know, everyone will have their experience with each particular midwife. So, yeah, tapping into the home birth communities is another way of really understanding the climate, I suppose.
Yeah. And jumping on Facebook is a really good way to do that. The Home Birth Group Australia Facebook group is a really good one to at least start with. And I'll link to that in the show notes, because as you said, there are local groups as well. We've got one here in the Wollongong region that you can get more specific local information. But if you're like brand new to this world, I feel like the Home Birth Group Australia page is just a good place to start.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so step two, you're pregnant, you've called your home birth midwife and said, I would like to hire you. What happens next?
Yeah, so it depends on the midwife and depends on where you intend to give birth. Some midwives have got visiting rights to hospitals. Some midwives only do home births. Some are happy to do both. So then you would phone your midwife and you, depending on the midwife, so for me, my clients, I recommend that they go to their GP and get a referral letter to my services.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of red tape. We're required to have a collaborative agreement with another care provider. So that can be a hospital or an obstetrician GP or an obstetrician or whoever.
Mm-hmm.
So I encourage women, just go off, get that letter, Come on back. And then you basically just start. So first visit, same kind of process as a hospital where you book in and we get to understand your needs. And private midwives can do all of your care, all of your antenatal care, all of your birth care, and all of your postnatal care for women who have no complicating factors.
Mm.
So we've got quite a scope of practice that we can actually do that. So a lot of my clients will never engage with a hospital, never have to go in there. At the moment, I do all home visits, and some midwives have a clinic space or a home office, or they do a mixture of home visits or whatever the structure is, which is, again, what you would discuss as you're searching for your midwife.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's kind of the next step, is you really just get started.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to add, because I find I hear this come up all the time, and I know you would as well, is when women go to the GP to get that referral letter, it's actually pretty common to get some pushback from the GP on that. They're unwilling to refer to a privately practicing midwife. They'll either refuse or they'll kind of give the woman a bit of a lecture. And because there's so much misinformation about birth in general and about home birth in particular. And I feel like it's just important to be aware of that in advance, so that you don't, as a newly pregnant woman, walk into a GP and be like, whoa, am I doing something wrong? Like,
yes, and that is, you're right. And that's something that I talk to my clients, you know, when I say, what's your GP? I say to them, you know, what's your GP like? And they're like, oh no, they're great. They're totally happy. I've already spoken to them. They're supportive.
Yeah.
Or they already know that their GP is going to, won't be supportive.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a few GPs in my area that I know will always give referrals.
Yeah.
But I do quiz the women a little bit, like, what's your GP like? And, you know, and give them a little bit of a spiel that they can give to their GP, because The other thing is GPs don't necessarily need to know that you're having a home birth, because that collaborative agreement is kind of around Medicare and our insurance, but none of that covers birth.
Mm.
So I often say to women, you know, just let them know that you've gotten a private midwife for your antenatal and postnatal care, because that's all that's covered. That's all they're collaborating with us on. They're not collaborating with us for the birth.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't need to feel like there's some kind of co-conspirator in this, you know, dangerous plan to have your baby at home. And So just let them know, I've got a private midwife. And certainly there are a portion of GPs who just won't do it. And that's, you know, technically their right is they don't have to refer you to practitioners that they don't believe in.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly have a few GPs in my area that I can say to women, look, if you're worried, just go to this one and you can guarantee you're going to get one.
Yeah.
Yes. And other midwives have got like a standing collaborative agreement with a particular practitioner. Mm-hmm. So some women might not need to go and get that GP referral, but that's certainly how I do it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Beautiful. And then what do you like prenatal visits look like in the lead up to birth? So when do you start? And so yeah, you were just kind of already explaining that it can happen maybe in the woman's home or in their clinic if the midwife works out of a clinic.
So the intervals of visits, I suppose, are pretty similar to the hospital, but always individual to the woman. So depending on what the needs are. I've had some clients who have had completely uncomplicated pregnancies, are feeling really confident and are happy to wait to, you know, 16 weeks to actually have our first visit and book in. Other women may have experienced, you know, early pregnancy loss in the past and be really interested in starting care right away to, you know, get all the ultrasounds, all the blood tests, do everything they possibly can to feel confident that this pregnancy is going to be different. So when I first speak to women for the information, for a little information visit, we can gather that. And also if women are previous clients of mine and they're sort of like, yeah, we'll book in at 16 weeks, it's totally fine. And so the first visit, it just depends on the women. And then for me, I do visits every 4 weeks until women are 30 weeks pregnant, every 2 weeks till they're 36 weeks pregnant, and then every week after that until the baby's born. And, but again, I always remind my clients, this is not fixed. It's just kind of the general structure. And then if you need more, then you can have more. If you need less, that's totally fine as well. And the visits usually go for about an hour. I'm quite heavily focused on education. And then at the end, we do blood pressure and check the fetal heart and all that fancy stuff that, you know, that you would get at a hospital visit as well. But a lot of it is about relationship building, understanding the woman in her home and her particular needs. And then, yeah, a lot. And then nothing much more needs to be said for the birth. You know, you've figured it all out. You know what each other is like. I know what the woman's expecting of me. She knows what I usually do. And so, yeah, the idea is that you'd be so well known to each other for the birth that there's not a lot of conversation that needs to go on at the time.
Exactly. And this is what's so, I think, important. I feel like this is almost the most important part of home birth midwifery, of this model of care, is that it all happens in the lead up to birth. So the birth itself is not much needs to happen because so much relationship building has already happened. Like, this was my experience with my home birth midwife. She just felt like a friend by the end. Like, she would literally just come, we'd have a cup of tea, have a bit of a chat. A couple of times I had, we were doing renovations during my pregnancy because you can't have a baby and not renovate or buy a house or something. And so we had tradies in the house. So she met me at the local park and did my antenatal visits there a couple of times. Like, such a complete contrast to the hospital system. And as you said, all of the education that happens, and it's almost, it's not just the woman being like educated about birth, it's the home birth midwife learning about the woman, learning what her expectations are, what maybe her specific fears are, what she is going to need in the birth. So that by the time the birth rolls around, it's just like a friend coming over to hold space.
Yes, and that's right. And so what we learn about women throughout their care means that we know how to look after them in birth. Mm-hmm. And I've had some women who are like, just to have told me, stay out of the way, mm-hmm. Jack, stay in another room, I'll call you if I need you. And other women who've said, don't leave my side, I need you, like, right there the whole time. And I'm like, that's fine. Mm-hmm. I don't have a specific way of being with birth. It's just however you want me to be with your birth, that's how I'll be.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think that's the learning process for us too, is, you know, what does this woman need from me? Mm-hmm. And then trying to meet their expectation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it. I want to backtrack just a little bit because I wanted to touch a little bit on routine monitoring during pregnancy. You know, obviously there's like all of the routine monitoring, or the other end of the spectrum might be a woman who wants no monitoring at all. So what are the requirements with a privately practicing midwife, and how much ability does a woman have to say no to routine testing?
There's no requirements. So I don't have any particular requirements at all of what testing a woman should have. And I see my role as being able to just give information and then the woman gets to decide. Mm. And there's a lot of trust in that you know, we just have to trust that the women do want to make the right decision for themselves and their babies. And I mean, women don't ever intentionally want to make a decision that is going to negatively impact themselves or their family. I mean, it's ludicrous to think that we want to skirt this dangerous line for fun. So I don't have any particular requirements. I've had clients who I don't even know their blood group, you know, because they've declined all blood tests. I don't know what their iron levels are doing. You know, we just have no idea. Some have had no ultrasounds, so we don't have understanding of exactly where the placenta is or... Mm. You know, all these, whether the baby's got a heart defect, we just don't know. But we have to then be comfortable to know that, you know, if a woman declines the 20-week scan, for example, the morphology scan, I said, that's okay. There are things that we won't know if you decide not to do that one. We don't know where your placenta's placed. We don't know if your baby has a severe or minor defect. We, you know, there's things we just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that? You know, at the time of birth, if your baby's born with something severe, we're not in a place that can provide immediate intensive care, for example, with a pediatrician and all these things. How do you feel about that? And we were like, no, I'm happy with that. It's fine. Like, okay. So long as you're aware that there's things that I won't be able to do for things like a severe heart defect, for example, I might not be capable of helping with that for the long term at home. And So I just inform the women of what we'll learn from all these tests, why that information is helpful, and the risks and benefits of each test, because I don't think any intervention is risk-free, But sometimes the risk of that intervention will outweigh the risks of the other option that we're trying to avoid.
Yeah.
So, yeah, for me, I don't have an opinion or a feeling about what women should do. I just tell them what we'll learn. And if that information is important to them, Then they choose to get the test. If the information is not important to them, they choose not to. And so for midwives, this can be really very, very uncomfortable Because it takes us, we have a comfort zone as well. So, you know, I do love women to get that morphology scan, the 20-week scan, so that I myself know, okay, this baby that's coming is put together exactly how it should be, And I'm not necessarily expecting complication, or I don't need to follow up on any particular things for this baby. So that's kind of comforting to know. So when you don't know those things, we ourselves are kind of outside of our comfort zone waiting to see what's going to happen as well.
Yeah.
That's really uncomfortable for a lot of midwives. But if we just document a lot of documentation, so we have full folders. I have folders here just coming up. Like, you know, all of my clients get one of these Folders and it's full of information about their pregnancy, about what I've done, all the different forms that we're supposed to fill in every time a woman declines something. You know, and so I go, okay, the woman's aware of her risks. I've written it all down. You know, there's no danger to me here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the woman's aware of if there is any danger. She's decided to take that on. So, yeah, I don't require, short story, I don't require anything. I just want women to make a choice from an informed place, and That my job is to help give them that information.
Yeah. And that's what I feel you do so beautifully. I was actually just watching, this is off topic, but you did a video recently on the research around the COVID vaccines during pregnancy. And I was so struck as I was listening to it by the fact that there was like zero opinion there. It was just, this is what the research says. Have a read of it yourself. See what you think.
Yes.
It's so refreshing.
Yes, I know, because I think it's really hard with everything. You know, women are told, yeah, you've got to do this test. And women sort of go, okay, if I've got to, I'd just really love to understand why. Why do I have to do this test? You know, things like GBS swabbing And the ultrasounds and all these things, they're not really given any information about what they are.
Yeah.
They're just told they have to do them. And so same with the vaccine. I mean, women are clever. We know how to make decisions. We do it all day long For ourselves and our families. So, yeah, there's no giving your opinion is not information.
Yeah.
And then expecting someone to respect you enough to just follow your opinion blindly, I think is misguided. So to Think, oh, yeah, well, I'm a clever person and I just told them to go get it. So they should go get it. That's Good enough reason. So, yeah, I think information, don't take it personally. You know, you've got to.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to ask you quickly was, we know, and let's touch on this in a minute, we know that the research tells us that for low-risk women, home birth is generally the safest place to give birth. But what is low risk, and when does a woman move outside of low risk, and when would you not be comfortable supporting a woman in a home birth? Like, what would have to happen in her pregnancy for that to no longer be something that you personally, I know it's different for every midwife. Well, maybe there's two parts to that question. What are you not allowed to support a woman with, and what do you personally choose not to support a woman with that you don't feel comfortable with?
Yeah. So we are required to follow the Australian College of Midwives consultation and referral guidelines, and they basically list out a whole level of complicating factors that might fall outside of the midwifery scope. And then it gives us guidance as to what we should do if that happens. So These things are divided into A, B, and C categories. So a C category is they're like, right, that's the end of the line. Refer this woman on. She no longer qualifies for your care.
Mm.
B is a consultation. So you can either consult somebody yourself, so a midwife or an obstetrician or somebody, or have the woman go and consult somebody. So, for example, like VBAC fits into a category B. So if you've had a previous cesarean and you'd like to have a home birth midwife, that's a category B. So having said that, there's also a form at the end of those guidelines. It's called a record of understanding. And it's a form that you fill out if the woman has declined your recommendation or the recommendations of the Australian College of Midwives. So if a woman comes to me and says, oh, look, you know, I'd like to plan a VBAC at home. Okay, that's a category B. I'm required to either consult with somebody myself or for you to go and consult with somebody about this decision. And if she says, look, I'm not planning on doing that. We'll go, okay, no worries. I'll fill out this record of understanding so that basically I write everything about VBAC that I possibly can and give her all the information that I possibly can about VBAC at home. She reads it, also writes what her plans are and that she's understood that information, and we both sign it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically a record that I've given this woman all the information. It's written down. She's signed it. It goes in her notes. So if anybody ever turns around and says, you know, you kept this woman hostage and you made her have a VBAC at home, I say, well, no, she was absolutely aware. So each midwife's scope is different. I know some private midwives who won't do VBACs at home, which is completely fine.
Mm-hmm.
I personally don't do breaches at home if I know mm-hmm. their breach. Mostly because what we know about breech birth is that the thing that makes the most difference to outcomes is the skill level of the practitioner.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that babies won't come out. You know, most of the time breech babies are born completely fine. And I've certainly had a handful of surprise breeches. But if a breech doesn't come down, there are particular techniques that you need to respond with to help it rotate and come down. And I just haven't seen or helped with enough breeches to feel confident that I'm the right practitioner for somebody for that.
Yeah.
And so I just tell women, it's not my skill set. You know, if something doesn't go right with your breech, you don't want me to be the one who's making decisions about how to get it out, because I just haven't had enough experience in that. So, I personally don't do breeches at home. So there's nothing that we're not allowed to do. However, there are, you know, twins at home. There's some pretty good research that suggests the outcomes aren't so great for twins mm-hmm. at home. That does require a special sort of skill set. And so, you know, historically, midwives who have really stepped out of the midwifery scope have found themselves in, you know, in trouble
mm-hmm.
with various, you know, organizations. And so I think we sort of step this really delicate line between what will we do and what won't we do. And that's about personal scope and comfort and experience levels.
Mm-hmm.
So when I first started as a very new midwife, I only took the lowest of the lowest risk women, no health issues, no previous cesareans, nothing like that. So, you know, you start where you're at and then, yeah, gradually you get more experience. So I don't really classify women as high risk or low risk either. Like, I feel like that is it's a construct in itself.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've had clients who are 42 years old and the hospital's like, whoa, you've got to go to the high risk clinic, you know, and I'm sort of like, hang on, let's have a look. What's your diet like? What's your health like? What's your lifestyle like? You know, a 42-year-old vegan yoga teacher who meditates every day and has never smoked and, you know, is a healthy weight, has no health conditions, mm-hmm. got pregnant easily. Like, you're not dealing with a 42-year-old body. You're at that point.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, there's so much scope. It's all very individual.
Yes, exactly. Like exactly right. Like having these kind of broad guidelines is maybe useful at a population level, but at the individual level, it has to be individualized.
Yes, but I think that's the benefit of having your own care provider.
Mm.
And when birth care is not done in a systematic way, so when you work through the hospital, I call it birth by numbers. They have a process, you know, step one is this, step two is that, step three is that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to take step 3.5 3/4, that's not on their map. It's not in their scope. It's uncomfortable. So whereas you know, we don't follow a system so much. We just follow the woman's needs. So it's a very different model completely.
Yeah, totally different approach. And I think that's why it's always worth asking if somebody's making, if a care provider's making a recommendation to you, are you making this recommendation based on guidelines and like population level statistics, or are you making it based on my unique case? Because those are very different things.
Totally.
Yeah. Mamas, a quick interruption here, because if you're listening to this episode, I'm going to go out on a limb and assume it's because you're interested in having a beautiful, undisturbed, physiologic birth. Did you know that the vast majority of women are capable of having a physiologic birth? So research from around the world tells us that about 85% of women are capable of giving birth without interventions. But despite all this, only a very small percentage of women in developed countries today actually birth their babies without pharmaceuticals or interventions. So if you're wondering why that is and how you can maximize your chances of having a safe and empowering physiologic birth, I want to invite you to grab your free copy of my guide, The 4 Things You Actually Need to Know to Prepare for a Physiologic Natural Birth. You will find precisely zero fluff here. I put this 20-page guide together to resource you with everything you need to have the birth that you dream of without the misinformation overload you get from searching all over the internet. I am tired of seeing mamas waste their time with distracting, irrelevant, and incorrect information and practices that don't actually make a difference to your likelihood of getting the physiologic birth that you want. So in this guide, I'm giving you the evidence-based information as well as the practical strategies that I know work, because these are the things that have supported me and the mamas I serve to have safe, beautiful, empowering physiologic births. So you'll find that guide linked in the show notes. Go and download it right now before you forget, or you can jump online and you'll find it at jessicahodgins.com/guide to birth. That's jessicahodgins.com/guide to birth. It's called The 4 Things You Actually Need to Know to Prepare for a Physiologic Natural Birth, and it's yours to download now. Okay, back to the conversation, mamas. Okay, so we've kind of talked through what antenatal care with a home birth midwife looks like. So let's come to the birth, because this is the bit that people tend to want to focus on, right? And it is, it's a big deal. So what does it look like? Can you paint a bit of a picture of what it looks like for a woman birthing with a home birth midwife? What would you do? Mum gives you a call when she's in labor. What happens?
So once I arrive to the home, again, you know, even arriving to the home is the decision of the woman. I've had some women who've called me and I think, oh man, I really should get out there. She sounds like she's about to have her baby. And they're like, no, I'm fine. And even that is her decision.
Yeah.
So I don't kind of impose myself on someone's birth, even if I think that they're just about to push their baby out. So, and in the flip side as well, you know, if I think they're in really early labor and they go, no, I really want you here. I'm like, okay, there's something they need from me at this point. It's not midwifery care, because early labor, anyone can do. It's something else. So that's part of my job as well. So I basically then arrive. I tell them, you know, just carry on with what you're doing. Leave the door unlocked. I let myself in. I have a birth kit with 3 different bags and an oxygen cylinder. So I arrive and just kind of, I lay them out always somewhere where the woman can't see them, because I just can't imagine how mortifying it would be to be in your beautiful birth nest that you've created and then to look up and just see all this equipment. So I intentionally put that out of the view of the woman and just respect the space that they've set up, because, you know, women think about their birth space throughout their pregnancy, and I just hate to impose this terrible scene into that. So that's the first thing I do. Then I just sit and listen for a little bit and kind of just get an idea of what they're doing, the sounds that they're making, how often the contractions are coming, how well the woman's coping through them, how supportive her network is there. You know, has she got a glass of water next to her? Is it warm enough in the room? Are the other kids occupied? You know, all these little things, just kind of really tapping into the space and becoming part of it rather than cutting through it and, you know, going straight to the woman and going, how are you going? What's been going on? You know, so it's more just kind of learning, sitting back and learning for a minute. Then I'll sort of gently approach the midwife who trained me. She said, never stand over a woman. Always get low on their level, you know, which is what we do. Even when we talk about even respecting children, mm-hmm. it's come down to their level. Don't speak over them or above them. So come down to where the woman is, and then just sort of, you know, ask, do you mind if I listen to your baby? And then have a listen to the baby, and then ask, you know, is there anything you need from me? And often they're sort of like, and there's just a few words, not too many words, because women aren't mentally in a place to have a big conversation or make decisions when they're in labor. You want to leave them in that mental process of labor. Mm-hmm. And so I just will often say, everything seems normal to me. Everything's going fine. You're safe. And back away, and just, you know, only be in their space if they've invited you in. So sometimes they'll sort of ask questions like, you know, what's going on? And what do you think I should do? And, or they'll say, look, I feel like maybe stuck, something's going on. And often I will have already been thinking that, like, mm-hmm. oh, why is this slowed down? And I wonder what's going on. And then the woman usually, you know, 10 minutes later is like, something's not right. And I'm like, yeah, I was just thinking the same thing. Mm-hmm. You want to try and have a walk around or do some stairs or something. So it's a very quiet process. You know, I don't ask a lot of questions because all of the questions I would want to ask are usually already been answered. Mm-hmm. And if there's something not quite right, the woman usually knows. And if there's a time where I say, look, I think we might need more care, I think we might actually need to be in a hospital, they've often looked at me and gone, yeah, I think it's time. Yeah. You know, they've felt the same thing. So, yes, and then there's a second midwife as well. Mm-hmm. So the second midwife gets called when you think the woman's about to start pushing is a good time. Mm-hmm. We don't always get it right, but having watched physiological birth for so long, you can tell when someone's fully dilated and when they're about to start pushing their baby out and factor that in. So
I just get excited by hearing about physiologic birth. So how do you tell, like, without cervical checks, what are the things that you're looking for in a woman to know that she's about to start pushing?
Yeah. So the sounds change. So another thing that I did early in my research career was this study called the birth position study. And basically I just went and watched all these women laboring, and my job was to record the times and what they were doing physically and what it sounded like and what it looked like. Mm-hmm. And what we noticed was that in early labor, women are more interested in moving around and being upright and a lot more chatty between contractions. Then as labor progresses, they get quieter and lower. And I can't really describe the sounds, but even if I sit outside of a room, I know what the baby's doing, where the baby is by the change in sound. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's just an attuned skill from having been with birth in that way. But yeah, I guess if a woman has previously been quieter and starts to make noises, you go, okay, we're starting to really work through contractions now. You know that, okay, they must be getting stronger if she's feeling like she needs to engage her voice. Sometimes a woman's voice goes more high pitched if, you know, as the baby starts to move down, it's kind of like a, ooh, like a, whoa. And then there's just that reminder to kind of, okay, bring it down, open, loosen. Even by the face grimaces, you can just see when they're really starting to work harder than they were before. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's the purple line, but it's not always reliable. It's just such a subjective mm-hmm. experience to feel that someone's fully dilated without having put your hands on them.
Yeah.
And I remember taking a woman to hospital once. There was meconium in the Lycor, and I thought, oh, I feel like, you know, there was just a few things that made me think we should be doing this in hospital instead. And before we left, we did a vaginal exam to see where she was up to, and she was 9 centimeters. So I thought, right, you know, by the time we get to hospital, she's just going to really have progressed and she's going to push her baby out and we're going to come back home again. Mm-hmm. And we got there and they're like, we want to do another vaginal exam. And I said, well, I'm telling you now, she's fully dilated. And they said, you can't know that. And I thought, yes, I can. What do you mean I can't know that? And I said, no, you can't know that because they don't know how to determine fully dilated without diagnosing it as a vaginal exam. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh, no, I can know that. I know. I thought, there's anal puckering. She's making grunting noises. There's a full purple line. She's acting like a woman who is going to push her baby out.
Yeah.
I was in no doubt that she was fully dilated. Plus, she was 9 centimeters an hour prior. So yeah. I'm like, well, the likelihood is that she is. So, yeah, it's very tricky. I think that's the skill. It's a different midwifery skill to have that at home than to, be able to work it out.
Yeah, totally. Because it's like you can know that, and it's not just because you trust physiologic birth. It's because you've literally seen it so many times for so many years. It is a skill that you've acquired that, of course, you don't have it in hospital, like as someone who regularly practices in hospital, because you don't see physiologic birth. So you don't have that same trust in your own ability to judge where a woman's at.
Yeah, and I think, too, in hospital, they might recognize it, but there's not really this opportunity to sit with a woman for 12 hours and do nothing else in a hospital. There's a lot of things that a hospital midwife has to either block out or engage with outside of the room that takes your attention from what's happening for the woman.
Yeah.
So I don't have any of that noise. So I'm able to completely, experience the woman's full labor without being interrupted.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where that different knowledge set has come from, is the opportunity to not have to engage with the other.
Exactly. That makes so much sense what you're saying. And also, as you're describing that, just affirms to me again, because as I was saying, all of the research shows that for low risk women, home is the safest place to give birth. And this is why, because you are not focused on anything else except this woman. That's your one job.
Yes. And we know her and we know what to expect. There's always an intricacy of things for things. And, if I know that this woman's been working really, really hard to get her iron up, for example, and she's been really struggling with it, and we've worked with all different kinds of supplements, and the blood tests aren't reflecting the work she's doing. And if that woman starts to bleed a bit more, immediately I'm thinking, whoa, she hasn't got the capacity to lose that much blood. And I might intervene sooner than I would a woman whose hemoglobin's like been 145 and they haven't been on any supplements, and you're like, totally, this woman, she can afford to lose a bit of blood, and I know she is really fixed on not having the injection, and so we're going to have a lot more engagement in that. Whereas if the other woman has said to me throughout her pregnancy, if I start bleeding at all, I want you to get my placenta out straight away, just that knowledge directly impacts how you act in the birth, depending on the woman.
Again, it's just that highly individualized care, isn't it? Okay. I know a lot of people's concerns are is, when do I, like, what might happen that means I need to transfer to hospital? So can you talk a little bit about what are the common reasons that a woman might choose to transfer to hospital during labor?
Yeah. So first time women having their first babies are more likely to transfer than women having their second.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the reason is just tiredness.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's a really long early labor, or the labor that's just gone on and on and on, and women just think, oh my gosh, I just need a sleep. Mm-hmm. I just need a rest. So there's been, there's a number of those that just kind of want to go in, have an epidural, have a sleep, and then refresh their body and push their baby out.
Mm-hmm.
There are times where the woman is pushing for a long time, and for some reason the baby's just not coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's usually about the position of the baby. Either it's posterior or asynclitic, where the head's kind of kinked into the pelvis and is not in a position to come out. And, there's things we can do at home, but there's a limit to that. So sometimes we transfer for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
What else? So obviously bleeding, too much bleeding. But to be honest, the use of syntocinon in the event of a postpartum bleed rather than actually preemptively. So we do physiological birth of the placenta at home, where we don't give an injection for it to come out. And that way, if we do need to use syntocinon to stop the bleeding, it's very effective.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we don't transfer often for postpartum hemorrhage because the medications that we have in order to manage it are really, really effective. I think we've probably only transferred 2 or 3 times in 13 years for the bleeding that we were kind of like, why isn't that stopping?
Mm.
So, yeah, what are the other reasons? Changes in the baby's heart rate.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing that we're good at is we use intermittent monitoring with a Doppler rather than with the CTG.
Yeah.
So what we get really good at is using the Doppler and knowing when it's a normal heart rate and when it's not. And, you know, often we don't need to know why the baby's heart rate is changing. We just kind of go, okay, that's an abnormal heartbeat. Probably that's an indication to head into hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Usually it's fine. It can be as simple as the cord is wrapped around the baby's neck. And so every time the baby's pushing down, you're getting these weird heart rate patterns and the baby comes out and you go, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Now we know why that was happening. But I don't personally hang around at home and wait and see what happens if we keep going.
Yeah.
You know, for me, you know, the safety of home birth is that we identify when we're out of our scope, where mm-hmm. things become abnormal. And when things become abnormal, that's the time where hospital's really great.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's just about when things are beautiful and normal, home is perfectly safe.
Yeah.
And most of the time they stay perfectly safe and normal. And when they're not normal, that's the time where we get help from people. Yeah. With that. Yeah.
And I think it's really important to say that because it's not home birth at all cost. It's, you know, in while things, as you say, are healthy and normal, as in like within normal range, home birth is the safest place. And once upon a time before we had medical care, women and babies did die in childbirth. And this is what the advantage of medical care is, not to use it preemptively because that brings additional risks, but when it's needed to just unhesitatingly, like when the time is right and you know that it's right and the mum knows that it's right to transfer into hospital for a higher level of care, and that is okay. That is not a failed home birth. That's home birth working how it's meant to work.
That's right. And that's sensible and appropriate midwifery care.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people are like, oh, it's failed home birth, I'm like, no. And I also encourage women to not see me as a home birth midwife.
Mm-hmm.
So that sometimes women come and go, well, I don't know if I want a home birth. And I said, but do you know if you want a midwifery carer?
Mm-hmm.
Because really I'm a midwife, and whether you're outside or at home or in hospital or wherever you are, I'm still your midwife. And it doesn't matter where you choose to give birth. You've had continuity of midwifery care and you can make your choices within that. So, yes, I think that an appropriate transfer is just safe care. Mm-hmm. And it just highlights the safety of having a private midwife is that mm-hmm. actually we have some knowledge about when it's time to not be pursuing home birth anymore and to move into hospital. And my transfer rate is about 10 to 15%.
Yeah.
It's most of those are not ambulance transfers. You know, it's unusual to travel in an ambulance to hospital. Usually it's kind of a well thought out kind of, you know, maybe we should move in.
Mm.
Maybe let's do this there. The other reason that we might occasionally transfer is if a tear is bigger than what we can repair at home, perineal tear. So we can repair a number of tears at home, but if they get too big or complex, you probably want an obstetrician to fix that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
And I feel like, yeah, so 10 to 15%. And to hear that most of the time when you transfer, like it's not a high percentage of the time to transfer into hospital. And when it happens, it's generally not an emergency. It's okay. Yeah. We're going to calmly and collectively and rationally think about this and decide to move into the hospital setting. So it's not like, oh my God, mum and baby are going to die. Like, because that's the fear, right? Like I think for a lot of us, that's the kind of vision of this terrible emergency happening, and not that emergencies don't happen, not trying to downplay that, but just to recognise the proportion of time when most of the time that's not the case.
Yes. And I do encourage people too that when you don't need to fear in birth and it's actually unfolding physiologically, most of the time if things are going wrong, they go wrong slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the jobs of the midwife is to go, this is slowly going wrong. And actually then that's the time where you move and change the plan. rather than seeing it all the way to the end and going, ah, oh, damn it, I didn't pay attention to the things that were going wrong 2 hours ago and here we yeah. are now in an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
So the trick is really is that we move in before it's an emergency if something's going wrong. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, with things like inductions and things that are interventions, things can go wrong quickly, but that's because you've interfered in the process.
Yeah, it's not physiologic birth.
That's right, that's yeah. right. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like the other really important thing to point out here is that when you do transfer into the hospital system with a private midwife, this is the person who's been with you for the last, you know, maybe 9 months, who knows you, whose approach to birth aligns with your approach to birth. So, because I found this really comforting to know that I had a midwife who I really trusted. So I didn't have a birth plan for if I had to transfer into hospital, because I knew that whatever decision my midwife made would be the decision that I would have made if I were in a position to make that decision. So to have someone that knows you and whose approach to birth aligns with your own is just really comforting, because it just yes. takes the fear out of it a little bit of transferring in.
That's right. And that's the importance of trusting your care provider.
Yeah.
That if your midwife had said to you, I really think we actually need a cesarean at this point, mm-hmm. you're like, mate, we are on the same page. And if that's what you think, then yeah. I'm on board. Yeah. Whereas if a stranger walked in and said, I think I need to give you a cesarean section,
mm-hmm.
you've got a lot of questions about their motivations, their philosophy, you know, what's in it for them. Is my baby really in danger?
Yeah.
You know, there's no an agenda for a private midwife to say, oh, I think you should have a cesarean section. You know, we as much don't want you to have that
yeah.
as you don't want it. And so it's, I think that's what we talk about with trusting your care provider. Mm-hmm. It's so important with decision making.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we've talked about birth and the process of the birth itself. So what does the relationship with a privately practicing midwife look like postnatally generally?
So I personally see my clients for the first 3 or 4 days in their home,
mm-hmm.
and then at day 7 and 2 weeks, 4 weeks and 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. But again, that's all very flexible. Some women need a lot more care than that and others need a lot less. You know, I might turn up on day 3 and they're like, I don't know why you'd come back tomorrow. Just don't.
Yeah.
So, generally midwives will provide care, private midwives will provide care up to 6 weeks, 4 or 6 weeks. And that, I think, is actually one of the most amazing things about having a private midwife,
mm-hmm.
is sitting at home in your bed with your family, knowing that the care is coming to you
yeah.
and that you've got someone you can call 24/7, because that's mm-hmm. the thing, is that we're on call for women all the time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if there's any issues with breastfeeding or there's a complication, women know they can call you or send a photo of something. You know, the number of times I've been sent photos of, is this normal?
Yeah.
In the middle of the night. And that postnatal care is something that's really lacking from a lot of systematic maternity care.
Mm.
It's always been very, very choppy.
What is it like? Because I've only birthed through the home birth model. Like, what is the care that's generally provided if you birth through, say, the public system?
It depends on the hospital. Some hospitals yeah. have really good home visiting services, others have none. So mm-hmm. the minute you leave the hospital, you're kind of left to wait for the community nurses. So basically, once you have your baby in hospital, they send off a little referral to the community health service, who is supposed to come and see you, I think, 4 to 6 weeks after the birth, or potentially, depending on the area, maybe sooner there's a visit. And often that's about identifying at-risk families who might need ongoing support. So, and then sometimes those nurses are not supportive of breastfeeding, or they don't really know what they're doing with breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. And so if a woman's having trouble, they're like, oh, I don't know, you know. You're falling into the care of another healthcare provider that you haven't chosen,
yeah.
Who turns up to your house to give you some advice.
Yeah.
So some hospitals have got like at-home midwifery visiting services, but again, they don't usually extend further than a week.
Yeah.
And then there could be this gap before you see the community health nurse, and that gap could be enough time to develop a breastfeeding issue and give up. if exactly. you haven't got any support.
Yeah.
So, you know, breastfeeding rates for women who have private midwives are excellent because we have 6 weeks to work through and navigate the issues, to refer to lactation consultants if we need to, mm-hmm. give women confidence that actually breastfeeding does take time and effort to work at sometimes, that you need to see this as a skill that's being developed over weeks and weeks and not mm-hmm. days and days. Yeah, that's in a nutshell what you get.
Yeah. And it does, it's like, it's so true, because suddenly you've got this baby and you're like, well, shit, what do I do with it? Like, this was, you know, my experience having my midwife. So she felt like a friend, and I was like texting her. My little boy had a tongue tie, which she literally also is an amazing lactation consultant, and diagnosed like at his first cry, and didn't tell me. Obviously she didn't want to plant that seed with me, but she knew. So she knew that when I was having pain in the first few days, it could be rectified like straight away without waiting weeks and weeks and ending up with a long-term issue, or like, you know, newborn acne. And I was like, is this normal? Yeah, I was like, yes, it's normal. It's okay. Just okay. having that reassurance.
Yeah. And there's always that day 10 or 11 where you, you know, the family texts you and goes, why is the belly button bleeding? I'm like, oh yeah, the 10 and 11 day belly button bleed. Like, I don't know why it happens, but everybody seems to get it. It's probably nothing. You know, yeah. And it's just that early support, the postnatal support, I think. And, you know, getting into your bed after having your baby and just crawling into your own bed.
Yeah. Like, yeah, it's huge. Guys, that's where I'm going to leave the episode today, because as I mentioned, Mel and I chatted on for a lot longer, and right after this is where we moved onto the subject of Mel's research on why women choose to birth outside the mainstream maternity system and what that tells us about the system. So if you're interested to hear that episode, and you should be, because it's where we both get a bit fired up and real, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so that you don't miss it. And while you're there, it would also mean the world to me if you left a review, because that's how Apple knows to share this podcast with other women. And if you want other women to know this information so that they can make informed decisions for their own birth too, that's the way to do it. I hope you enjoyed today's episode and found it useful. If you did benefit from listening to this conversation with Melanie Jackson today, please take a screenshot of your phone right now and share it on your Instagram. Don't forget to tag me. I'm at Dr. Jessica Hodgins and Mel at Melanie the Midwife, so that other mamas can get their hands on this information too. I'll be back next week with the rest of my conversation with Mel. Love to you, mamas. And until then, stay wild. Thanks for listening to the Wild Mother Podcast. I'm living and mothering on the unceded country of Darawal people, and I gratefully acknowledge their ongoing work and the work of Indigenous people everywhere in the service of thriving life on Earth. Stay wild, mamas.